Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Inventing the Future podcast. I have Eric here. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Of course, of course. Excited to have you on. Eric is a fellow Founders Inc. builder with me here in the F.Dot Inc. space in San Francisco. But yeah, man, really excited to talk today. We've gone on hikes. We've had like cool combos in the past. So excited to see where the flow will take us today. But yeah, to start off, Eric, I'd love to just hear a little more about your upbringing, background, and your early influences that led you on this wild journey of being a founder.
Yeah, just a little bit about myself. Made in Korea, born and raised in South Korea for the first 18 years. And then I moved to Minnesota with my mom and stepdad. Learned English, went to school for mechanical engineering. And then when I was 25, I packed all of my shit in my car and drove to San Francisco. I had maybe $2,000 in cash. And last year or so, I lived in Mexico and Brazil, kind of avoiding the pandemic and lockdown. And then I recently came back to SF. Yeah, what led to being a founder? I think like ever since I was young, like I was interested. This word businessman sounded interesting to me. I think it could be because my father was an entrepreneur. He always was working on some sort of business, some man's jewelry, some sort of like a lottery. I think he had a bar at some point. Some of these interesting businesses.
Trying different things.
I don't think any of them really worked out that well. But yeah, when I was young, I'd always say that I want to become like a president, businessman, conquer the universe or whatever, half jokingly maybe. Yeah.
Conquer. How's your quest to conquer the universe going?
Oh, okay. So I realized that actually that's not too realistic. So.
What do you mean? Anything is possible.
I don't think that's what I want to do anyways, but I do want to, you know, create a lot of value. So I think building a business is probably a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So that's like one of the main draws then, the desire to want to create an impact, influence. But like, I mean, where does that desire come from though? I guess you have some early influences from your dad, but it seems like there's an external purpose beyond that.
Yeah, I really don't understand this myself, but I think ever since I was young, I had this desire and interest in improving things, whether it's myself, people around me, some sort of system around me, product, service. Whenever I see something, I saw, oh, this could be improved this way. And I actually tried to actually make it better. And I think that just seed just kind of grew. And so I believe that everything changes. So the only thing that doesn't change is that everything changes. And I think it'd be better if it's changing for the better. Mm. And I want to be a part of this energy that makes things better, faster. So yeah.
Interesting. Which is interesting. We'll jump to this later, but a lot of your product and the company you're building is about better, faster, cheaper. Yeah. So, but we'll go there in a bit. So you grew up in South Korea, right? Yeah. And you moved to Minnesota when you were how old?
18.
18. Yeah. Okay. And then you went to college in Minnesota?
Yeah, University of Minnesota.
Right. And then, okay, you went to college and then you said you drove all the way here to San Francisco. What happened there? Why were you like, whoa, I hear like a calling here. Why go to San Francisco?
I think after moving to Minnesota or the US, I started hearing about this place, mystic place called Silicon Valley, where a 20-year-old kid gets funded, builds a large business, which isn't quite easily possible in Korea, especially if you're young, because there's a little bit of ageism. So if you're younger, you don't get as much respect. And I heard about this place where young people build large businesses. So I had always been interested, but San Francisco is very expensive. I didn't have any friends or family or money. So it was kind of scary. But then I think I had heard about Airbnb guys driving from somewhere to San Francisco. I think they also drove in like some sort of Honda Civic or something. And I had like a Japanese car. So I was like, this seems like it. And before, I lived in Minnesota for 7 winters. And I decided I'm not going to have another one. So I think it was maybe October before the 8th winter. And I decided to pick all the stuff in the car and just drive. That was probably one of the most adventurous moments in my life, driving alone for almost 7 days, sleeping outside or camping outside in a few different places, some gorgeous places.
Huh, interesting. Do you feel like that was an impulsive decision, like just fuck it, I'm going to go? Or was it very thought out, planned, and something you wanted to do for a while?
I think a little bit of both, because I had been thinking about it and had been procrastinating on it at the same time. And there was a little bit of impulses and, okay, I gotta fucking do this. Otherwise, I'm never gonna do this.
Yeah.
So, and one day I just pulled trigger and then I just quickly put together stuff and decided to drive.
Yeah. Pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
And so once you came here, what happened? Was it the magical place you thought it would be, or how has it turned out to be when you moved here?
100%. The moment I drove into the city on a highway, I felt that this is my home. Like, I don't know what it was. Maybe I was just lying to myself somehow. But then, you know, just the vibes. I like the plants that grow here. There's more, you know, variety. And then as soon as I started meeting people, I suddenly realized this is the place. And I feel like San Francisco is more home than any other place that I've lived in. Mm. So I lived in Mexico for a while. I lived in Minnesota, obviously Seoul for a while, South Korea. And this is the only place I feel like this is my home. I think one of the reasons is because most people who live here came here for a reason. They are from somewhere else other than San Francisco. And something along their journey triggers something. And then they got a calling and then they made the move, moved out of wherever they grew up, and then moved their ass over here. And I think there's some sort of energy with that. Everyone's trying to do something. They moved out and things like that.
Interesting. And did you know what that reason was for you when you moved here, or it was still fairly abstract?
It was fairly abstract. I think I was just looking for something better. I was looking for an adventure.
Hmm.
And I just knew that there were going to be more opportunities here, although it was scary as hell.
Yeah. Put yourself in the right environment and a lot can spring from that.
Yeah.
So then where does entrepreneurship, becoming a founder, come into this picture? You move here. Were you immediately like, oh, okay, time to be a founder? Or how did that come to be?
I think the first time I started something was when I was in junior year in my college.
Hmm.
I started starting projects. I wouldn't quite call them like startups, but self-initiatives. I started with some sort of hardware, startup ideas. Hmm. And then I ditched them because it was so hard, not as scalable, hard to build prototypes. And eventually I started learning to code and that just kind of changed everything. But yeah. Started in college.
And then you've had 3 companies now, right? That you founded, or how many?
Depends on how you count it.
That's true.
I would say I have dozens of ideas that I worked on.
Okay.
Yeah. Actual companies that I incorporated, maybe 3.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. And so it seems like one thing I've noticed from those 3 companies, and I don't know if the other ideas relate to this, but they all seem to be around a common theme of transcription, automation, AI. We'll talk a little bit more about Unreal Speech in a bit. But yeah, where did this constant theme of automation, AI, transcription, why did that pull you and why have you stayed in that space?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of different things. First, automation. The second is what theme that I've been working on, which is under the umbrella of automation, I think. I think automation is my passion, and I think automation, well, first, it's inevitable that a lot of things will be automated.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be up to us as to like what we automate and how we automate it, and do we automate it in a way that it's net negative, or do we automate it in a way that it's net positive? And I think it's going to be net positive, largely 3 ways. One, by reducing the cost of basic needs. Imagine automating, say, agriculture, make producing food almost zero cost. That could be one. Number 2 would be automating unfulfilling dangerous labor. Number 3 would be providing infrastructure for self-education. Imagine some sort of AI who can teach you, personalize, who can write content for you or something like that. And that third one is something that I've been working on, which I don't have any resources to like automate agriculture yet. but I think software is probably a good place to start. And past 5 years, I've been working on tools to help people consume information. So the transcription company, what that did was it was like Google Translate for videos. One of the ways I learned English was to watch a lot of YouTube videos with closed captions and subtitles.
Oh, wow.
And 70%, over a majority of YouTube viewership, is non-English speakers, or they speak English as a second language.
Wow.
And then I realized that now that I can watch videos in English without subtitles, like I realize how much content there is, like great educational content in English, and then a lot of people around the world cannot access it. So I wanted to make every video accessible to everyone around the world, regardless of what language they speak. I had that, and the reason I'm passionate about helping people consume information is because if I can help everyone around the world consume information, maybe 1% better, I think that's going to compound very quickly. So in terms of my motto around creating as much value as fast as possible, I think helping people educate themselves more easily and more effectively is probably like a strategy, I think.
Yeah. Interesting. So you felt that impact of what the transcription did for you in learning English, and you kind of saw the bigger picture of what that could become. And actually, one quick question I have here on automation that came to mind is, you think most things or almost everything will be automated. What are some things you think shouldn't be automated?
I think human connection.
Is that automatable?
I don't think it's automatable. I used to think creativity was going to be not automated, but then I started seeing the Stable Diffusion and like text-to-image generation. I'm like,
it's next level.
Okay, I don't know about that yet. depends on like what kind of creativity. I don't know. What will not be automated? What should not be? Something that we can talk about down the conversation is I'm passionate about helping children, specifically orphans. And I think the human connection between their caregivers and children will not be automated. Mm. And I think almost everything else should be automated so that caregivers can focus on making connections with their children.
Yeah. Which goes back to what you had said on not automating connection. And I can't remember where I've read this, but I read something that even though you can automate, say, like a bank teller or like scheduling for an appointment, things like that, some people, even though the AI may be better, they still want to have that human connection.
Right.
I think it was with coffee, actually, right?
Yeah,
they would
yeah.
still prefer to have a barista because of the human feel of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. Like, even it's not only just is it automatable and can it be better, but it's still that connection is really hard to be able to replicate, if at all.
Yeah, 100%.
Interesting. So yeah, tell me then about the journey. So you had audio reads and then you ended up transitioning to Unreal Speech. So tell us a little bit about both of those and how that transition and pivot ended up happening.
Yeah, so I started audio read because I wanted to read this blog by Paul Graham. He has like over 200 essays and I wanted to read all of them, but I couldn't even get myself to even read one. And one Sunday, I decided to turn all of his essays into podcasts using Amazon's text-to-speech technology. And I put them in my Apple Podcasts, and I ended up listening to 5 of them back-to-back while completely reorganizing my room in like a couple hours or something like that. I'm like, holy shit, I can read and do something else at the same time. So I gave it away to a few friends, and just random people started reaching out asking for access to the podcast channel so that they can listen to the essays. And I quickly turned it into a Chrome extension. And that was probably the first product that I built that I thought there's some real interest coming in. So I turned it into a product. Kyle and I, my co-founder who started AudioRead with, we launched on Product Hunt. We got some attention. We got over 10,000 users in the first couple of months. But eventually, though, Amazon's text-to-speech technology that we were using was so expensive and also not as good as it could be, so expensive that we couldn't get the business model to work. So I was forced to look into text-to-speech. And I had zero expertise in machine learning and anything like that, but I was forced to look into it. And I ended up coming across some revolutionary research and jumped in, did some R&D, taught myself machine learning a little bit, and ended up training a model that actually sounded pretty good, maybe better than AWS. So I thought that this is a better business, probably, building the backbone technology, like, you know, building infrastructure so that other entrepreneurs can build on top of our text-to-speech technology, as opposed to us building Chrome extensions and mobile apps and other use cases ourselves.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And I've used audio reads, by the way, and it's pretty great. I'm subscribed. And it's great. You have an extension. You can go to any page, any article, and click a button, and it basically transcribes it and sends it to you on your phone as well to be able to listen. So really convenient. But what I find fascinating here is that you took something that you were using basically an API, AWS, to be able to do this transcription. But what you realize is like, this is great. This works well as like consumer, but the bigger opportunity is probably the underlying infrastructure improvements and quality that you can do here. Mm-hmm. Because if you improve the infrastructure, then you're able to not just improve it for this one use case that you were doing. Now it's like when you do an infrastructure sort of things, it expands the use cases almost infinitely.
100%.
Right? So was that like your thinking on it or how?
100%. And I get to basically have hundreds of co-founders. That's how I think about it, because I'm going to be able to collaborate with a lot of entrepreneurs and builders, and I basically I want to enable them to build cool use cases.
Yeah. I love that. That's super cool. No, I think infrastructure plays are super powerful. They may be a little less sexy or unattractive for some people, in my perception, just because it's not directly to consumer. It's not a direct use case, but it's potentially way more powerful because of the increase in potential use cases.
100%.
So yeah, tell me a little bit more about like Unreal Speech. What problem are you solving? How does it compare with your lovely competitor, AWS? And what are you doing different and better?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways to think about it. One is helping people consume information. So it's kind of automating because, well, I mean, we can get more into this, but I think reading is an obsolete way of consuming information. So I think turning written words into spoken words so that you can listen to it, you're automating the reading part. Instead of you reading it aloud inside your head, you can have AI read it to you so that you can do something else while you're reading. That's one. And the other problem is that there's some price fixing going on in the market. So Amazon, Microsoft, Google, IBM, they somehow accidentally landed on the same exact pricing, which happens to be pretty high. And it's really hard to build a startup out of it. So I think there's a lot of use cases that are being blocked by the current status quo. And that's one. And also the other thing is the quality of voices. A lot of people do not want to listen to robotic voices. So that limits the market size because the quality is a certain level, and then that only limits a certain number of people who's willing to listen to that kind of robotic voice.
Right.
So once it becomes like superhuman, I mean, realistic, and if it's like the cost, it makes sense, then I think there's going to be a lot more use cases.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I think the crazy thing here is Amazon, Google Cloud, like all these people, they have infinitely more resources than you do. And you're like a solo founder, right?
Yeah.
So how the hell did you build something that in theory is better and higher quality than these companies, given that they have way more resources, way more data? What the hell are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, there are bigger ships and I'm more like a jet ski. And I think we're playing slightly different games. If you want to ship a bunch of like thousands of people from San Francisco to Morocco or something, they have better resources. But then if you want to just like explore the area as fast as possible, Jessica is probably better. And I think that's what we have. And right now text-to-speech is going through like this, what I think is an inflection point, because the architecture required, the amount of data or the data that's required to build something that's realistic and also affordable is recently becoming possible. And I think for that, you need to experiment very quickly. You also need to experiment with the market in terms of like what use cases that's going to be enabled. And you need to like iterate quickly to build the products for the customers. I think we are at a stage where the speed matters more than anything else. So that's why we think we are going to win. 3 years ago, machine learning, especially text-to-speech, was something that only companies with large resources could do, because it used to be so expensive. Like GPUs used to be really expensive. It's gotten a lot cheaper. They're more available. You can like go to AWS and, you know, rent, you know, GPUs on demand. So there's a lot of these things that are available now that startups can kind of compete with lower resources.
Interesting. Yeah. So that probably only became possible recently, given the lowered cost of GPUs and all the other resources to your disposal. Right.
How to say so.
Yeah. But how did the machine learning come to part? Did you just Google how to do machine learning? How'd you even learn how to do that and build your own model?
Yeah. So there are some aspects of machine learning. I think there's the architecture itself. There's like a data engineering, and then there's like inference and deployment. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know too much about the architecture. I just know good enough to be able to compare different architectures and then see which one performs better or which one might be more commercializable. And what I did was collecting a shit ton of data, engineering the data, and then deploying it. And now I have an AI researcher that I work with who's handling more of the actual architecture side, who's going to be able to like customize it and dig deeper into that. But yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's impressive. But I'm also curious what you think about having companies like AWS, Amazon, and all these others as competitors. I even saw you tweet like, is it stupid to compete against AWS? That's a very legit question. What do you think?
Yeah, honestly, I don't know. I mean, like I said earlier, I think we are at a time where there's going to be new use cases that are going to be born, and I think speed matters. So I think...
What do you mean by speed, by the way? And speed in what sense?
Speed of iteration, speed of building products, speed of improving the products for, or like specializing into specific use cases and things like that.
Yeah.
Just generally moving fast and adopting and adapting quickly, adopting new technologies or new experimental architectures or something like that. Yeah, I don't know if it's stupid. I think Sam Altman once said something like hard companies are easier to build than easy companies or something like that. And since it sounds stupid, I think there's not a lot of startups working to compete with AWS. So we don't have as many startups, I think, in text-to-speech. So I think that makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Where does that boldness come from? Like, oh, I'm going to go and compete with like Amazon. Like, what made you even think I should even try to do that or that you could even succeed doing that?
I didn't really think that through that much. Like, I just,
That's probably why you did it.
No, I mean, if anything, stupidity maybe. But I started Audio Read, and then that just kind of forced me to look into text speech. And then it just was a natural transition into text speech. And I didn't really think too much about like, am I going to be able to compete with AWS or I don't know. I just went for it.
That's good. I love that. I mean, if you end up thinking about it too much, you'll... The thing is like, what I've realized is that if you go 3 years into your founder journey and then you look back into everything you had to overcome, and if you knew everything you had to go through in order to get to where you are now, you probably wouldn't have wanted to even start in the first place.
100%,
so it's even like a blessing in disguise that you don't go and try to figure out like how hard this is, probability, da-da-da, and everything else that comes.
I 100% agree with that.
That's funny. Okay, and I'm also curious in terms of competition, what if AWS was to, or these other competitors were either to bring their costs down to the same price as you or even lower, or they were to make the quality just as good, if not better than yours. How would you respond in that case? What do you think your current and future moats and unique competitive advantages could be?
Yeah, I don't have all the answers yet. I'll probably think about that once they reduce the actual price, and then I'll try to respond to that. I don't worry about these imaginary scenarios that much. Right now, I'm laser focused on getting the first, second, third customers and fulfilling their needs. Maybe this is a bad answer. Maybe I should be thinking about that competition. But if anything, I'm more worried about other startups than like AWS or Google.
Interesting. Yeah. Just because of how fast they can move, or why are you worried about other startups as opposed to AWS?
I think AWS, Google, Microsoft, they're too slow. And I also know roughly how the team's formed. Mm-hmm. And I think their incentives aren't as aligned as, like, say, founders. So I don't think those full-time employees. Imagine, like, you are a genius AI researcher at AWS. If you can come up with, like, this brilliant new novel way to make text-speech way better, would you keep working at your full-time job and make Jeff Bezos more rich? Or would you rather start a company and then build a company out of that? So I'm more worried about startups than, you know, people who are just kind of... Does that make sense?
It does, especially because, well, one, that's a great point on brilliant engineers at these companies that come up with a better way could just leave and do their own thing. Maybe some of them won't and just will give it. But I think the other interesting thing is that they just are able to move quicker, have more insights, and can do things better. But I don't know. That's a good way to think about it, though, when it comes to competition. I mean, 0 to 1, Peter Thiel talks about this a lot, where, you know, you don't want to like over index on competition. So I think it's a balance, and it's a tricky balance to get right, because you do want to be aware of this competition and what's going on. But at the end of the day, what matters most is just to know your customer, their pain points, and solve that and provide more value than anyone could possibly provide. And if you're providing more value than anyone else, you'll end up winning.
Yeah.
Amazing. And so another question I wanted to ask here is, so you posted your launch on Product Hunt, posted it on Hacker News. The Product Hunt community was very happy, friendly, supportive. Hacker News had like some criticism, which you, you know, complained about on Twitter and whatnot. But yeah, these people were saying, oh, it's 2 times cheaper, not 8x, or like, oh, I like the AWS version better, da-da-da-da. All these things. Yeah. How do you feel about that? But also in general, how do you think about dealing with this sort of criticism? Because honestly, it could... This is probably only the beginning, and as you grow and become more successful, more criticism will come. So I'm curious how you think about that and interpret it.
I love criticism. I think there should be more criticism openly. I think there's this lack of criticism, and I wish I was criticized more often by my friends and people around me. Because I think that, for me, seems to be the most efficient way, fastest way to grow and improve. Because otherwise, I'm just working in a beast. I have to somehow figure out what the unknown unknown is. Like, if we work together, and then if you can tell me, like, hey, but you could probably do this or that, and you could improve this way, I think that actually makes me grow faster. So, Hacker News, yeah, I thought that was way better than preceding 10 posts that I made that got no attention at all. And then I felt like I got a lot more attention, so that felt much better. And a lot of the feedback or criticism was super valid. And I incorporated, I think, at least 80% of that feedback, and I'm preparing for a relaunch. So,
yeah, I mean, criticism is really freaking hard to take. But I actually like Mark Zuckerberg's perspective on this. He was on a podcast, I think, with Tim Ferriss. I forget with who. But they asked him about the same question about criticism. And he ended up saying that, well, someone like him receives a lot of criticism all the time. But the way he sees it is that what he really cares about is the faithful critics. Because there's people that criticize you just because they want to like hate on you. And it's not really valuable. But there's people that care about you. And because they care about you and want you to be better, they criticize you so that you can improve. And so what he cares about and focuses on is those faithful critics. So I love that you have that perspective, because even though it's not easy to read or hear those things, you now at least have an idea of what the flaws are or what you can improve and get better at. So yeah, very important. Receive criticism.
Yep.
Cool. Would love to transition more into your current state of mind. What stage are you at right now? And what are the top of mind problems, challenges that you're going through?
Yeah, I think on the personal side, I'm going from this like a maker schedule to a manager schedule. Being a solo father, being the only person who can code at the company, I was on a schedule where I'm just always staring at the screen, coding as much as possible. And now I have 3 part-time engineers that I work with. So like my time is often better used by trying to figure out how to communicate better or how to strategize better and things like that, as opposed to sitting down and coding for a couple hours. So that's taken a little bit of time, or it's taking a little bit of time to just kind of switch my mindset from a bootstrapped solo founder mentality to small funded company with more than just myself. Yeah. So there's that. So I'm learning there in terms of what's on top of my mind. We recently figured something out and the engine got a lot better. There's still a little bit of work to kind of finalize a little bit, productionize it. But other than that, we are switching gears and switching focus from primarily focusing on engineering, which I've done for the last 1 year or so, maybe more than 1 year. I've been just head down, just engineering, not much selling. And now we're focusing primarily on selling and probably secondarily engineering. That's going to be interesting. A lot of sales and marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like there's 2 big transitions. You were basically solo founder, full building mode. Yep. But now you went, you hired some people, and it's not only a matter of managing them and building a culture. It's also like, shit, we got to start selling this thing and I got to figure out how to sell shit.
Yep.
So I guess what have been the mindset shifts that have been helpful? What's helped you make this transition and help you become a better leader and better seller at that point as well?
Right. I don't know if I have become a better leader yet, but I think the good first step that I took was that I just admitting that I'm not a good leader, and just that's a understanding that's like a weak area that I should work on. I don't know. What was the question again?
Well, how are you becoming a better leader then? So I love the humility there and the self-awareness. What steps are you taking to become a better leader?
That's a great question. I don't know. Something that I've been personally working on is trying to be more empathetic and trying to be more collaborative. Actually, my ex-co-founder, Kyle, he gave me great feedback after working really intensely with each other for about a year. And his feedback was that I should learn how to be more collaborative, which was a great fucking feedback that I've been working on. So there's, I think, probably understanding what's blocking me from becoming a better leader is probably a good step. And I think I have a decent understanding of what I need to improve on. So I'm good at doing things solo. So I need to learn how to be more collaborative, work in a team. Number 2, I think I tend to be maybe emotionally unintelligent. You know, I'm one of those like type A person my whole life. So I've always been good at executing, you know, doing things fast. but not as good at understanding how other people feel around me, how my behaviors and actions affect people emotionally, things like that. So I've been thinking a lot more about those and trying to improve those. And I ask for feedback.
Yeah, I love that. Especially in becoming a better leader or better at anything, it's kind of identifying first what's preventing you from being good or great at it. So that's a great starting point. Cool. And then you formed a team of three people. How'd you go about that? What type of people did you look for? And what do you think overall makes a good founding team, a great founding team?
Yeah, I don't know, honestly, but it's something that I'm still trying to figure out. But something that I look at is how fast they're growing as opposed to how much they know right now. Hmm. That's something that I keep an eye on. In terms of how I went about it, I just looked at what I was doing and how I could delegate and what kind of people that I need to delegate. And I feel pretty happy about the current situation. I think I was able to find a few people who offloaded a lot of the work that I was doing so that I can do other stuff.
That's good. That always feels magical when that happens.
Super happy about it.
And so have you been coding more now, or are you focused more on selling now? Managing?
Not quite selling yet. There's, I would say, a handful of engineering challenges that are left, although it's not as big as what we worked on last 1 year. Yeah, I've started coding a little bit. It's weird because like my immediate reaction to any sort of problem is to like, okay, how do I fix it? Or how do I do this myself? But then I'm trying to switch focus on to more like, okay, how do I communicate what the problem is, what needs to be delivered, and how do I find the person to do it? And there's this one task that I haven't been able to find a person to do. I started coding, and then in fact, actually, I'm going to try and get out of the VS Code, and then I'm going to try to go find some people, actually try to hit up some people and see if I can actually delegate or not. And if really I can't find someone, I'll probably just code a little bit for that one.
Yeah, and take it on yourself. Yeah, yeah, there's actually, I would recommend this great book called Who Not How by Dan Sullivan. And the title kind of speaks to the core concept. But basically, anytime we feel there's something to do, the natural instinct of most people is to ask, how am I going to do this, right? Yeah. It's basically putting the responsibility upon yourself. But his mindset shift is like, what if you asked who could help me with this or who could do this as the first question instead of the how? And it becomes a more relationships-centered approach.
Interesting.
And so for your case, the first who could be like within the team. And if not then who beyond that could either assist me that I may know or who may I need to hire or who knows the person that may be able to give me advice on who to find or hire, right? It's basically like an exploration of who that who is.
Interesting. I mean, now I don't feel like I had to read the book because I already know the gist of it and I just need to apply it. I wish I had an AI who can give me feedback like this.
Okay, I'm the closest to an AI. So. I'm an AI sometimes, but that's funny. Okay, cool. I'd also love to, you've been very much in this building mode, kind of like this journey of finding product market fit. Actually, like, have you found product market fit or where do you feel you are along that journey?
Not quite. I think there are some metrics. I know what metrics to track. And
what are they, for example? How do you know you're there?
Yeah, for example, one is mean opinion score, which is probably the best metric around like how people perceive the quality of the speech or how natural it is. Mm-hmm. So mean opinion score, and there's a speed. How long does it take to process a certain amount of characters? And then the cost. And I think those things are like top three metrics. And there's going to be some usage metrics and things like that that we can track to see if it's going exponentially up. But no, we have not found product market fit, although I'm inclined to believe that we're getting close.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nice. Getting hotter. Talk a little bit about this journey then, right? Because this 0 to 1 journey and finding product market fit is not easy and it requires a lot of building, shipping, iterating. What is your thinking on this, your mindset of how to approach it and how to constantly get closer to achieving that goal of finding product market fit?
Interesting. I mean, I've never found product market fit before, so I don't know if I'm the right person to answer this. But a couple of things that come to my mind is one, being honest about like the market feedback. I think in my previous ventures, I kind of ignored that too much. I wasn't honest with myself and I fell in love with my own product too much. And I wasn't really honest about how little market pull that I got. So that's one. And I think number two is probably having fun. I think it's going to be whatever it is, it's not going to be a short, quick, easy journey, product market fit. So it has to be something that you enjoy. And I personally really enjoy my job and the theme that I've been working on. So I mean, even product market fit is like, that's just the first step, basically, right? And then like, you got to scale and grow culture and then scale the culture and whatnot. So that's just the first step. And then there's like 10 years, you know, after that. So like, it has to be something that you really enjoy. And yeah, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's so important. And actually, I relate with that and resonate with that a lot because we're in the same place with Mindflow of like, fuck, how do you find product market fit? How do you get retention and growth up? And it's hard, but interestingly enough, I don't really feel like too stressed about it. The other day we had a day with close to no post, basically. And it's sad, it's hard, but at the same time, it's just such a fun thing to work on. And I'm so obsessed about it that it's like, it's fine. We're going to find a way through it. So I think that's the power of passion and purpose around something, that even if the results aren't there, but you're having a lot of fun, not just with what you're working on, but with who you're working with, it really makes a big difference in giving you the ability to persevere through those challenging times.
100%.
Cool. So you recently raised 300K, yay money. So tell me a little bit, and you raised it from some pretty cool people, Readwise, which I think is like a great,
founders, yeah.
Yeah, the Readwise founders, Sean Puri, the podcast host of My First Million and many other things. And then legendary Furkan from Founders Inc., the space that we're in here. So tell me about that journey, how that went and how you managed to convince these people to give you their money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a whole journey. Everything that up to that point mattered. Me moving from Korea to Minnesota, learning to code, learning English, and moving to SF, growing network here, and putting myself in the right environment, and iterating, not stopping, working on different things, and all of that. And the fundraise itself worked out pretty easily. I tried to raise before, but this one worked out pretty easily because I had worked on this demo for like a year preceding to that, and I had a pretty interesting demo. So that really mattered. Essentially, how it worked was the Readwise founders found us, and then we got on a call. They put in 5K each, and then that was great. So like, I have my first checks right away before I even started raising. And then the second one came in. One of my roommates actually worked with Sean Puri at the time, and he helped me send couple of sample demos to him. And then as soon as he listened to them, he was like, okay, we got to invest in this. And then 2 weeks later, that invest became 150K in the bank. And then Furkan knows Sean. So like, I went to Furkan and then, hey, you got your friend invested 150.
Good social proof.
Yeah. And then that conversation just fell into the places too as well.
Yeah. I love the story of what you did around with Sean Puri. I think it was basically you were able to do a demo, not just like a demo, but one specific in the voice of Sean Puri. So he was hearing back his own voice and seeing the potential of what this could be from his own voice.
Oh, it was actually a small correction. It was some famous people.
Some famous people.
Reading
okay.
his newsletter.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, reading his newsletter. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think that was really smart because it's obviously something personal to him that, and he could see the power of it.
Yep.
But I think that's really smart as a tactic, if possible, if people can figure out how to actually do that with their own product. And it's very personalized, which I think is the key behind it. How can you personalize your pitch, your demo to whoever you're giving it to?
Yeah, personalized demo as opposed to, I don't know, just cold emailing, dear sir, madam, I have good opportunity for you and, you know, things like that, as opposed to like, yo, just a couple MP3 files.
Yeah.
You know, trying something different.
Yeah, yeah. No, makes a difference. Makes a difference. And so I'm curious, you just not that long ago finished this raised. Mm-hmm. So curious if you have any like core thing that you learned or insight or any advice you would give to anyone raising, because this was the first time you raised too, was it? Or
yeah, technically I've been in an accelerator before that funded the company, invested a little bit of money, but this was, aside from participating in an accelerator program, this was my first fundraise. Yeah
So what was the core thing you learned, and maybe any core piece of advice you might share with people going on their fundraising journey?
I think I don't know about what I'm going to tell other people, but what I told myself was that, oh, like now that I have a better business, it's a lot easier to raise is what I thought. I used to think, I tried to raise with this Y Translator, the video translation company, a few years ago. And I was pretty disappointed that I wasn't able to raise, not even a single penny. And looking back, that company wasn't really that good. We didn't really have much technology. We didn't really have customers. The pitch or narrative story wasn't really that good either. And I thought it was about me. but it was more about, I think, the company. But then it was also about me because, you know, I'm the founder of building it. So, and then I had some growth personally and everything. And I think this company has more technology, like deeply technical stuff that builds moat around it. And, you know, I think there's more potential, more use cases, more TAM. And then it just allowed me to raise it more easily. So I don't know. I think fundraising is really interesting because it's complicated. We might need to have a good product, or maybe you don't have a product. Maybe you're just really good at selling, or maybe you have a good network, but you got to do something. What helped me was I don't really have that good of a network. I think having like a good demo helped. So you got to pick your battle. Are you going to have a really fucking great like narrative and story and then sell it? Or like, do you have like uncles who are super rich, or or do you have a great product? Do you have great traction? There's got to be something there.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the king in fundraising is traction and users and 100%. Growth. But that's also one of the hardest things to get. Yeah. So if you don't have that, then I think close seconds are, as you said, a good product demo that at least shows the potential. For me, what helped me with my pre-seed of 220K was just the network more than anything. That was the main, because we were pre-product as well. So it was like kind of very hard to fundraise without a core product. But if you have a network of people that believe in you, then that helps a lot. And if not, it's probably credibility, right? What's your previous track record? But if it's your first time in a startup, a lot harder.
So you got to have some evidence. And I think a good way to show that evidence is a product that you built.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Cool. So, Eric, one thing I'm very curious to ask you about is your work style and the balance you have with life. So if I'm not mistaken, you, I think, work from like, I don't know, 7 a.m. to like 2 p.m., something around that. And then you go surf, I think, almost every day. Is that right?
That's roughly correct. I think I start working around between 8 and 9. And I do probably 80%. I create 80% of my output in the first like 2 to 3 hours of my day. And usually after one or two after lunch, I usually get pretty groggy and not too productive. And I usually don't have meetings. So it's a good time to go surf.
I love that. Okay. And so this is very counter to how most founders or the culture around like hustle, grind all the time. Very counter to that. So why do you take this approach? And do you think, do you not worry of like, I'm not moving fast enough because I'm not working as much? How do you see this and why do you operate in this way?
Yeah, I see this. So velocity is what matters. Velocity is speed plus direction. So I think a lot of people think about just one or the other, probably speed. Speed as in how hard you're working. Are you working like 12 hours a day, sleeping like 4 hours a day or something like that? But you might not be heading in the right direction. So that might not be as productive. So I think you need to be heading the right direction as well as going as fast as possible. And that as fast as possible also is going in the right direction is probably a little bit easier, but then going as fast as possible could mean different things and at different stages of life. For example, like when I was starting Y Translator, I was coding 12, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. I don't know. But then like I also, looking back, I think I could have done more of zooming out, relaxing a little bit more, and then kind of having a more bird's eye view of where things are heading. I think I could have done that better. But generally speaking, and also I had a time in my life where I was working on my startup during the day, and then in the evening I was like serving tables, so I had to work 16 hours a day. But for example, if I do that now, if I'm starting my company, I mean running my company and then serving tables at night, that would not be too effective, right?
Right.
At this current stage of company. Yeah, so that's how I think about it. And I think I could be completely wrong, but my current thinking is that it matters a lot more for me to set the right direction right now than to be actually pedaling. Or I think I'm more at a stage where, how do I find more leverage? How do I go to the right direction as opposed to me actually putting the physical labor of some sort? So for example, like if I have to go from point A to B, I got to first set the destination right. So where am I going? But then how do I get there? The first instinct might be to run there or walk there. But then can I get an Uber or can I get an e-bike to get there? When, you know, I had to think about different tools and resources to get there. And I think I'm at a stage where it's better to stop and strategize and then I'm going to just, you know, walk there or run there as hard as possible kind of thinking.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's a great approach. And I love the analogy too of like, I've thought about this before of basically the difference between walking versus running. And there's like trade-offs, right? If you're running, you'll get to your perceived destination a lot quicker, obviously. But if you walk, yes, you're going slower, but one, you're able to appreciate the path and the journey a little more. You're not out of breath or tired or whatever. And two, you get to like question if you're even on the right path. Is this even the right direction? It's like, right. If you're walking, you can look to your side and be like, oh, wait, look, there's a better path over there. Yeah. Maybe it's a shortcut, or maybe I was like, screw my initial destination. I'm going somewhere else. But there's also downsides in that, like, oh, there might be a pretty penny on the path that you might get distracted by if you're 100%. Walking. Whereas if you're running, you'll like bulldoze through it and you're fully focused. It's kind of convergence versus divergent thinking. But I like how in this current phase, it sounds like what's most important is having that space to explore and walk and think and consider what the destination is. If you had absolute clarity and determination, would you probably then just be more heads down and working?
I consider myself to be heads down working. I think I'm more focused on output than anything else. For example, like fundraising. So going from engineering to fundraising was a very interesting process because my work style drastically changes. So to give you an example, I was just head down, just like staring at the screen, like coding multiple hours a day. To when I started fundraising, my schedule was completely empty. I would have maybe 2-3 meetings that day. And then what I primarily focused on was to have a good mood and transfer like positive energy within my meetings. And the way to do that was to surf. Yeah. So I would like go surf before investor meeting and I'll feel good. It feels like I have meditated and, you know, my heart is pumping. I have good energy. And I think that mattered more. So that disciplining myself to not worry too much, just kind of stay chill, get rid of the anxious energy and not worry about whether I'm going to be rejected or not, and bringing in a good energy, I think was more helpful. So that was, in my mind, hard work because I had to switch from just head down doing something and remove unlearning a lot of the habits and then quickly jumping into just selling mode, basically. Selling is a lot about transfer of emotion and going from this nervous, hardworking, like just like narrow focus to like just kind of more laid back, good energy, vision, long-term, high-level stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's super self-aware to realize. And it's kind of interesting because you're out there, you're surfing, you're having fun. But indirectly or kind of directly, it's putting you in the right mental state to actually perform a lot better. So it's kind of hard of work, but at the same time, it's obviously more so just fun.
I 100% consider it to be an extension of work. I personally believe that if you don't know how to rest, you don't know how to work. And I have a lot of discipline around rest. For example, like instead of having a morning alarm, I have nighttime alarm. So it starts bugging me to like, you got to start winding down. You got to start doing stretches. And then if I do those nighttime routines right, I wake up just fine. If I go to the bed at the right time, for example, something like that, or like I try to go as far away from work on Sundays as possible so that like come up with different ideas, things like that. Or like surfing is great because I get to meditate. I get to do some physical exercise. It's like mentally challenging, a lot of novel experiences. And I go outside. I'm in nature. I'm like connecting with nature.
And you're in flow.
Yeah, I'm in flow. It's freaking awesome. Yeah, I think like every entrepreneur should have some flow routine that puts them in flow outside of work. It could be running.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jiu-jitsu.
For me, it's soccer.
Climbing, soccer. Yeah, soccer is fantastic. It's just super physical. You got to have one of those activities.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy because for myself, when I play soccer, it's kind of like probably the only time in the week or day in which I'm thinking about nothing. My mind is blank. Yeah. I'm not thinking about anything at all. It's just full focus, concentration, and flow. And probably in the background, my subconscious is like debugging shit.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. I agree with that.
I think when I'm surfing, my background unconscious part is just also suppressed in some ways because when I'm getting like just punched by a set of 10-foot waves sometimes. Last Sunday, I think it was like super huge. It was like 10 to 15 foot waves. And when I'm like getting tumbled and shit like that, like I'm not thinking about debugging. I'm like, I'm getting pretty close to death, or at least like that's what it feels like. And having those routines of just kind of refreshing my mind is just so helpful. And I think people should have a routine around also recharging and recovering. And
yeah, that's fundamental. You got to have good routines there. Great. So Eric, I have a final question for you. I'm curious, what is the vision you want to create for who you want to become and what you want to achieve, create, and give in this life? How do you want to invent the future and create this new future that's coming?
Sure. So I read this statistics. There's 152 million orphans around the world. and 10% of them kill themselves before they become 18. Mm-hmm. And 60% of over a majority of orphan girls become a victim of sex trafficking at least once in their life. And my parents got divorced when I was like 10, 11, 12, and I saw one of my friends losing their parents from a car accident. So I think I've always kind of resonated, deeply resonated with what it could be. Like, I feel like I think I could have been an orphan. And I can't fathom how hard that could be and how disadvantageous that could be. And there's 152 fucking million orphans around the world. So my goal is pretty simple, which is the same way the founding fathers of America started the foundation of a country that went on to become or build the greatest economy, let's say, after they died. So I want to build the foundation of an organization within my life that will continue to grow after I die to eventually help all orphans grow without disadvantages. And so I see it as three phases. So one is, I think the fastest way to get to that is to start a highly scalable software business and scale it up. And in the meantime, I gain social capital, soft skills such as leadership skills and financial resources and things like that. And basically learn to like start, maintain, and grow organization. So I do that first phase of my life for profit. Number two, phase two, I start and build this foundation of this nonprofit organization. And phase three is going to be after I die, where this thing continues to grow and it'll be basically living forever.
Wow. How did you create a vision like that, so powerful and beautiful? Where did that come from?
I mean, it's iteration. It's still changing. I think it went from, I'm 29 now, and when I was in early 20s, I thought I wanted to be like Genghis Khan or something. have 20 wives and a bunch of children, which was, I think, more self-centered thought or more selfish thought. I think one day I asked, okay, why do they have to be my own children? What is it about then? And I didn't have a good answer to that. Yeah, so and then I started thinking differently. And then I heard about how many orphans there are. And at some point, I wanted to have like 10,000 children that I helped before I die. And then, holy shit, I should just focus on building this organization so that it can just continue to grow. I think that's going to be my gig. So yeah, it's been changing.
That's cool. That's beautiful. It's really inspiring. I love that dedication. It's great, especially because there's like a deeper, broader, more powerful purpose behind this current phase, and it leads to something greater and bigger. I think visions like that are what pull you forward. And when you zoom out into that bird's view, as you're saying, I think that's the type of shit that juices you up. So I love hearing that.
Love it.
Cool, man. Well, thank you for being on. It was great to chat. And yeah, where can people follow you along the journey and see not only you, but also your company and your vision continues to evolve?
Yeah. So my company is at unrealspeech.com, but then that might change. You know, I have like 8 different Gmail accounts, all the failed email addresses. So that might change, but I'm currently at eric@unrealspeech.com. My Instagram at automationist. Twitter is at automationism. I'm not really that active, but that's probably a good way to connect.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome, man. Well, thanks again for coming on.
It's been super fun.
It's been super fun. Yeah. It has. Cool. Thank you all for listening. And as always, be infinite, my friends.
All right.
Hey, guys. 3 quick footnotes here before closing off. So the first is, did you enjoy the topics discussed in this episode? Well, I invite you to join the Slack community for this podcast, where we'll keep the conversation going by engaging in discussions related to the episodes discussed in this podcast. Here, you'll be able to engage in conversations with me and other listeners. And if you really enjoy this podcast, it is likely that you would relate well with other listeners that also enjoy the podcast. In this community, you'll be able to meet, engage, learn from, and potentially collaborate with the like-minded entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast. Let's invent the future together. The second quick note is, if you are interested in receiving updates on new episodes, I invite you to subscribe to my newsletter. And in this newsletter, I'll also share notes, insights, wisdom, tools, and strategies that are designed to help you become a better entrepreneur and live a healthier, fulfilling, and more productive life. And finally, the last footnote is that you can follow us on social media accounts to get updates on new episodes and engage with invaluable content related to entrepreneurship. And also, we have a website now. You can go to inventingthefuture.ai for detailed show notes on all the episodes. So the links for joining the Slack community, subscribing to the newsletter, the social media accounts, and the website can all be found in the show notes for this episode. So with that, I would like to wish you a day, week, year, and life filled with an abundance of love, energy, and prosperity. Take care and stay infinite, my friends.